On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're checking in on the work of the People's Maps Commission that was formed in January of last year through an executive order by Governor Evers. And its charge is to redraw district political boundaries for consideration by the legislature and do it in an inclusive and transparent way with public input and ultimately an end to partisan gerrymandering. Are Wisconsin's maps unfair or drawn in the right way? How does it affect how you are represented, how you're heard? 800-642-1234. Dr. Christopher Ford chairs the 9-member People's Maps Commission. He's an emergency medicine physician in Milwaukee. Dr. Ford, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it seems the revised census figures, the census data, would be a linchpin to the work that you're trying to do of redrawing maps. What has the delay meant?
You know, since the beginning of this process, you know, we've been calling audibles from the lines of scrimmage. And so ultimately, you know, with the pandemic and with everything having to do with the pushback of the census numbers, we've really been creating our process, honing that process that we'll utilize once we get that census information in place. And so everything that we've been doing has ultimately been preparing to get those numbers, which are, we are expecting August 16th. And so we should hopefully be hitting the ground running as soon as we get those numbers.
Yeah. You know, what are you doing to prepare as you wait for these numbers?
Yeah. And so what we've done is we have created a criteria that we'll be utilizing in order to apply to our maps that we draw. And so all of this is available on our website. You know, people can go to govstatus.egov.com/peoplesmaps, where you can see hours of testimony that we've had from over 1,000 Wisconsinites, over 20 hours of our public hearings, as well as the meetings that we've had. In addition to that, too, we've been working with the MGGG lab, the Tufts University, with their software that's called Districker. And we've been utilizing that software using 2020 ward data that is available to us right now and creating some preliminary maps in order to sort of work with some numbers to have hands on. So when we get that data August 16th, we'll be able to go ahead and just plug and chug.
Plug and chug. You know, the people on this maps commission, they come from all walks of life, none being a political background. How do you know how to draw maps? Like, who helps you in learning how to do this?
Yeah. So, you know, I can say a lot of people have been very helpful in this whole process. And so ultimately, we've all come from a place of just hearing a little bit about gerrymandering, some of us more than others. None of us have come from a political background. None of us have come from a legal background. However, after listening to over 65 counties and 245 municipalities and over 1,000 Wisconsinites, as well as 18 redistricting experts throughout the county, the country and Wisconsin, you know, we have over the last several months have become, you know, pseudo experts on the topic, applying some of that data that we've learned, some of the teachings that we've learned from the people of Wisconsin and hearing what they want. And so through that and through applying what we've learned, we are hopeful and we are very confident that we'll be able to produce some maps that the people of Wisconsin state that they would want and maps that they'll be proud of.
What are some of the narratives? What have you heard in terms of your outreach and what you've heard from the public?
From the public, a lot of the hearing testimony that we've received and some of the testimony that we continue to receive in the written format have been very, very much along the lines of people don't feel that their maps right now represent who they are and represent their communities of interest or represent their communities at all. People want us to keep intact these communities, and they want us to keep intact county lines as much as possible in order to reflect their communities and reflect their ideals and reflect everything that they feel is a part of their day to day. And so a lot of people are saying that they don't feel that way. They don't feel that they're represented in those maps and they're not reflected in those maps. And they want to stick to one person, one vote as much as possible.
We're talking with Dr. Christopher Ford, who chairs the People's Maps Commission, represents the 4th Congressional District. You can join in. How would you like to see Wisconsin's district maps redrawn? Do you think our state's current maps are unfair or are they working? How have Wisconsin's districts affected the way you're represented and your voice? 800-642-1234 to join in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Ford, last month, Governor Evers vetoed a bill by Republicans that would have delayed local redistricting. What was your reaction to that bill?
Well, you know, the beauty of being an independent commission is that we're not involved in the political aspect of things. And we, you know, I can't really speak for the governor's office and I can't speak for the legislator as well. But, you know, it's business as usual here at the People's Maps Commission. We have in place everything that we need in order to keep going. And, you know, we feel confident that once we get those numbers, we'll be able to turn out our maps in a very timely fashion. And so we're hoping to get those numbers and hoping just to go forward with our ultimate goal.
You know, when you say business as usual at the People's Maps Commission, I'm wondering how much work is being done by the commission together? Like, how much time and energy are you putting into this?
Yeah, so, you know, we have, since the very onset of this, have put in over 20 hours of public hearings, and that's just the hearings alone. You know, we ultimately intended for our initial process to have been completed by now, but with the pushback of the census data, we keep moving back the goal line there. And so, you know, I can speak for myself as well as other members of the commission and can tell you, it's hard to quantify how many hours we have spent talking to our experts, talking to each other, being in a virtual setting. And we haven't met in person as of yet, but we're looking forward to it given the pandemic, as well as going to the virtual website, which I would recommend anyone who is listening right now to do. It's available on portal.wisconsin-mapping.org, where you can have interface with our mapping software, Districter, as well as, you know, teach you to draw and submit maps through that portal.
Yeah, so you're wanting people to try out this work on their own, to try drawing maps on their own. How does this work?
Yeah, so once you go to that portal, what it does is it links you directly to the data that we have for the state of Wisconsin. And so you'll be utilizing a similar software that we will have. You can see the maps that other people have submitted. You can submit full state plans or just communities of interest. You can district your ward if you want. And from that, what we're doing is we are keeping a running tally of everyone's maps. And we will eventually, once we get our census data, we'll be able to overlay the maps that we have with what you have supplied, and then truly reflect to see how far we have deviated or how close we are to what you have placed there, and take that into consideration. So each and every map that is submitted and each and every testimony submission that we have in community of interest will be considered by the People's Maps Commission, and we're looking forward to getting more.
Dr. Ford, you know, in these conversations about redistricting and maps giving one party political favor, a bigger advantage in elections, some of the terminology that's come up is packing and cracking. And I'm wondering, as you look at the maps that people draw, you know, what are the goals that you see? Or do you see, you know, maps drawn in very different ways? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, and so, you know, you'll see different maps produced by different people throughout the state. However, you know, I feel as though a lot of the maps that we have right now follow our criterion relatively spot on. And so, you know, if you go to our website here, you can see our criteria that we have. We have grouped by order of criteria. And so contiguity, just meaning that the district is one part is connected to the other part, compactness, as you were discussing as well, you know, keeping the districts as compact as possible, as well as preserving those political boundaries, are all a part of our first group of our criteria. And so we're seeing some of those maps being reflected in the ones that have been submitted to our portal.
We have emergency medicine physician Christopher Ford, who chairs the People's Maps Commission, that has sought to get public input on the redistricting process that happens once a decade alongside the census. What do you want members of the commission to know as they redraw maps? What is at stake for you? Have you been involved in the process? Attended a public hearing? Join in. Your take, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here in the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, earlier this month, Governor Evers vetoed a Republican-authored bill that would have delayed the redrawing of local political maps for a couple years. Updated census data, as we've been talking about, is not expected until next month. We're checking in on the work of the People's Maps Commission, formed by the governor, to draft fair and impartial maps. What do you want to know about the so-called efficiency gap, or how you measure partisan gerrymandering? Does your district represent your voice? What is your solution? 800-642-1234. Dr. Christopher Ford is chair of the People's Maps Commission and is with us for about nine more minutes. Let's go to Michael now in Lake Geneva. Hi, Michael. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, hi, Kate. Thank you. And Dr. Ford, I appreciate you being on the show. Mom, I have a background in GIS, and I have a question about the comment he made earlier about keeping communities together. You surveyed all of these people, thousands of Wisconsinites, and one of the things that they want is to keep communities together. Well, as a map maker, as a map drawer, wouldn't the process of attempting to keep communities together during the districting process, wouldn't that be inherently gerrymandering? That's how I would define gerrymandering, is using any outside process absent just the data to create political maps. So, and I can take my comment off air. I'm just curious. I mean, I have a master's degree in geography, and I'm just curious how that map making process doesn't become biased if we're using data outside of just pure raw data. If it's not just numbers that are creating these maps, how is that not inherently gerrymandering?
Michael, thank you. Dr. Ford.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is something that we've been discussing since the very beginning, and I would invite you to go back to our website, because you can see some of this when we discuss these principles. And so there was even one example that was provided by one of our experts on the topic, and he discussed one of the districts in Illinois, in Chicago, actually, that encompassed both the Mexican-American as well as the Puerto Rican-American population. And so the cutout of the district actually looked to be consistent with, you know, the principles of classic gerrymandering that we've seen. Essentially, made a horseshoe in the middle of the city of Chicago. And so, but what they really honed to, what they really spoke to in that respect, is it was more so trying to keep that community intact and to provide that community with the representative as they shared common interests and bonds, and they felt as they should, it deserved consideration by an elected representative. And so these are all things that we're considering as well. If there's anything that looks off or anything that looks to be, in a regular shape, we're definitely considering that and putting it up against our criteria. I will also state, in addition to that too, we're currently in the process of hiring a GIS consultant as well through the University of Wisconsin Systems that'll sort of help us throughout this process and to prevent anything that would run afoul of those criteria.
Yeah, I mean, we had heard too of systems where you just put all of the census data into a computer program and you run that software program and voila, you have maps, but it is not as simple as that.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Owen now in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, the biggest thing that I see here in the rural counties throughout the country, I've lived in different places throughout the United States, is the disenfranchised voters that make up most of the labor here in our rural areas, so especially in agriculture. A large percentage of the disenfranchised labor aren't even represented at all through a vote, and most of their employers are all Republicans. So the Republican districts in the rural areas appear to be very strong, but it doesn't adequately represent the actual population base and the labor here, because there's so many disenfranchised people that contribute to our GDP here in the rural areas.
And when you say disenfranchised, would you be talking about migrant workers on dairy farms?
I don't believe that they're migrant, because most of the people I work with on the dairy farms live here 365 days a year, and they haven't returned back to their actual, country that they are considered citizens of in 15 or 20 years. So they're probably American citizens just as well as you and I, but they have a citizenship in another foreign country.
Dr. Ford, how do you take into account disenfranchised voters and how you draw those districts?
Yeah, and so, ultimately what we're doing is we are looking at all those registered through the census at this point in time, and hopefully we can get that information August 16th. However, I would invite anyone to go to our portal, and again, that website is portal.wisconsin-mapping.org. And so in that, what we have is a link that you can input any communities of interest. And, as an update here, we're talking about any resident that shares any common interest or bonds that deserve a consideration, again, by elected representatives. And so, those are usually issues outside of the political arena. And so these are either common ethnic, cultural, other bonds, such as unique environmental, transportation, or educational concerns. And so all those things, we're hoping to get those communities of interest so that we can reflect them in our maps as well.
We're talking with Dr. Christopher Ford, who chairs the People's Maps Commission, representing the 4th Congressional District, and taking your calls about redistricting, 800-642-1234. We heard from Ruth in West Allis, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Ruth was redistricted in 2012 out of a Democratic district, and now Ruth is part of the WOW counties, the Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington counties, and feels like has no influence, Ruth says. Do you feel and is wondering, is there any hope that this can change?
Yeah, well, we hope so. Our goal is to, continue to strive toward that ultimate goal, which is one person and one vote. And we feel as though by drawing fair, nonpartisan lines on the map, on the maps that we have created, and by reflecting those ideals of the people of the state of Wisconsin, that we will get there. But we need everyone's help with it. And so we're hoping that we get more and more maps and more representation from where people feel as though their communities are outlined.
One of the criteria of the commission is using, is to look at communities of interest and, highlighting communities of interest. What are these communities?
Yeah. And so, these are communities that usually will share some common interest or common bond. And so, as I stated before, ultimately a lot of these groups usually do not promote a particular political party. They don't promote a candidate or any jurisdiction. However, in keeping these bonds intact and keeping these economic, ethnic, cultural, or other bonds that they all share together, we feel as though these folks need consideration by an elected representative. And so once you have that elected representative in place, you can continue on with making decisions in your community by ranking higher rank priorities and making sure that everything that you believe in your community is reflected in your voting, essentially, and what those representatives vote in.
Let's bring in Joe now in Reedsburg. Joe, hi.
Hello there. How you doing?
Doing well.
I got an idea. I tried to try to figure out who to contact and everything, but this works great. The whole problem with the gerrymandering and everything is, with the political parties and all that stuff. I think the easiest way, once the census info comes in and you can get the maps drawn up in probably 5 minutes, and it's really simple. Imagine you got a map of Wisconsin. Now draw a line horizontally through the state, dividing it in half roughly. Now this line slides up and down so that the north half and the south half have the exact same population inside the line. Now divide those halves with vertical lines, and they slide east-west until those parts have equal populations. And you just keep dividing the state up so that every area has the exact same population. There's no gerrymandering. It's all done by computer, probably 5 minutes done, and it's done. And there's no way anybody can say it's not fair because it was all exact same. Each representative has his district that was drawn by computer, and it has the same population as the one next to it and everything. It's all, there's no way it can be gerrymandered or anything.
So Joe sees this as a seamless way to do this, Dr. Ford.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Joe. I'll tell you, Reedsburg has a special place in my heart. It's the first town in Wisconsin that I ever went to when I was a kid growing up. So I appreciate your input. I would recommend that Joe or anyone else to continue to go to that portal again, because you can have hands-on with that software that we have. And I will say, the toughest part that we've come across as a commission is try to maintain that part of that population deviation when doing these maps. And so, you know, as much as we would hope that, you know, we could apply some of those techniques, it is really difficult to continue to evenly distribute given the way that the population is stratified in the state of Wisconsin. However, we are continuing to hone our technique and to continue to strive towards that, limiting that population deviation and creating that 1% balance as much as possible. And so, you know, I would invite Joe and everybody else to go to that portal and get hands on, and we'll take a look.
Dr. Ford, very quickly, what do you do if the legislature ignores what you offer?
Well, you know, and I'll give the disclaimer that I am not a lawyer, I'm a physician. So, but what we'll be doing at the end of our process is submitting our maps to the legislator, as well as everyone else with the Wisconsin.gov email. And so that'll be there for the legislator to review. And then after that fact, the legislator will submit their maps. And then if any discrepancy occurs between, what the legislator has and what the governor's office has as well, then likely it'll end up going to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And so beyond that, it is my understanding that the Supreme Court will make a decision based on all the bodies of evidence that are available. And again, our evidence is available on our website for anyone to view.
Dr. Ford, thank you for joining us. Dr. Christopher Ford is chair of the People's Maps Commission representing the 4th Congressional District. News update is next on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call on the line. He announced earlier this month that the state has reached a settlement with Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin. The multi-billion-dollar settlement spread across nearly every state stems from the opioid epidemic. It's expected to bring Wisconsin more than $65 million. What questions do you have about the opioid settlement or how that money will be used? What issues do you want the State Justice Department to investigate or litigate? 800-642-1234. Attorney General Josh Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back in the program, Kate.
Well, this settlement, more than $4 billion with Purdue Pharma across multiple states, how did the parties land on $65 million for Wisconsin?
A little over 2 years ago, we brought suit in Wisconsin against Purdue Pharma and one of the members of the Sackler family. The Sacklers are the family that owned Purdue Pharma. And not that long after that, Purdue went into bankruptcy. And what's a little bit unusual about this bankruptcy proceeding is that the members of the Sackler family joined that proceeding. Usually it's a company going through the proceeding, not individuals. But they put forward a proposed bankruptcy plan that would have involved a certain amount of payment. And about half of the states in the country thought that that was sufficient. But the other half, including us, said that the amount that the Sacklers were putting up wasn't enough. So we fought for additional resources. But we've now gotten to the point where we think we've gotten the Sacklers to put up as much money as they're going to. And that's what's reflected in this new proposal.
We hear about the financial costs on communities by opioids and the word abate, compensation to abate past and future costs of opioids. Are these funds coming to Wisconsin enough to abate what has been done?
They're not. You know, one of the problems with the bankruptcy process is that it's an acknowledgement that the amount that is really owed exceeds the amount that's going to be paid here. These funds don't unfortunately come close to measuring up to the size of the damage. But what they can do is really make an impact in helping to make communities safer and help to address this epidemic. And one thing that's important to note is that, we're in line for about $65 million here, but this isn't the only case. We recovered more than $10 million from McKinsey, the consulting company, before. And it's our hope and expectation, frankly, that we're going to recover from others as well, and that all of those funds will go to help fighting this epidemic.
Yeah, how do you want the money to be used?
I want to maximize the amount that is going to fighting this opioid epidemic, and there are a variety of different uses that the money can go towards, and a lot of local communities across the state are going to be working to make those decisions. But I think it's particularly important that we invest in treatment for people who are struggling for substance use disorder, that we support recovery programs, and that we work to prevent people from becoming addicted in the first place.
There's the 70-30 split the governor signed into law some weeks before the announcement, to divide opioid settlements. So 70% goes to counties and local governments, 30% goes to the state health department. Would you support that kind of split?
I'm supportive of that type of allocation. That law that was passed and signed into law by the governor doesn't apply to this particular resolution for a few different reasons. But I think getting money to local and county governments to the extent that we can is exactly where that money should be going, so that we can get resources into communities and help make a difference as soon as possible.
Attorney General Call, this is reaching far back, but what has been learned from the tobacco litigation settlements of the 90s for how Wisconsin and other states would use the proceeds of the opioid settlement today?
There are a couple major concerns that were raised about how the tobacco settlement funds were used. One is that a lot of the funds that were recovered as part of that those cases didn't go to fighting to promote public health, but instead went to fill budget holes and for unrelated purposes. And then a second issue is that the attorney's fees in those tobacco recoverments were the tobacco settlements were enormous, and funds that could have been going to promote public health unfortunately went to huge settlements for attorneys. So here there are a couple things that are being done differently. One is we are including as conditions in some of these resolutions that the funds go to abate the opioid epidemic. They won't be diverted to some other purpose. The attorney's fees issue remains to be determined. And one of the concerns that I had with the bill that was recently passed about the allocation of funds is that it doesn't cap attorney's fees. Mm. My hope is that we will see counties in Wisconsin negotiate with their attorneys to try to reduce those fees as low as possible so that as many resources can go to fight the epidemic as we can get.
We're discussing the state's opioid settlement with Attorney General Josh Call. What questions do you have for the Attorney General about the settlement with Purdue Pharma? What do you want to know? How has your family been affected by the opioid epidemic? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Attorney General, is the amount that is coming from Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers, is that enough to hold companies accountable or get their attention that this is really serious and a warning to other drug makers?
You know, I think it is a sign that there's a need for reform in our system, that the Sackler family, the members of the family that own the company, are going to be able to walk away from this bankruptcy still as extraordinarily rich people. The bankruptcy judge made a decision earlier in the case to allow the members of the Sackler family to join the bankruptcy process. We opposed that. But right now we're at a point where, we've got to do what's in the best interests of communities in Wisconsin. And that is, I think, to move forward with this resolution. So, if it were up to me, the amount that the Sacklers would be putting into this resolution would be far higher. But it's also important to note what's happened here. I mean, Purdue is going to fundamentally be ended as a going concern in the form that it was in before. The Sacklers will be paying billions of dollars to resolve this. So it's not as much as I would like to see. And I, given the harm that was caused here, I don't think we would ever reach that amount. But it is enough to send a clear message that there are very serious consequences for this type of false and deceptive marketing.
The deal, if approved in court, would require Purdue Pharma to provide millions of documents and the communications about its tactics for selling opioids. What would you hope to learn from these materials?
Yeah, one of the things I mentioned earlier is that we had held out for a better resolution in this case. And part of that was financial. And the increase in the amount of money that the Sacklers are going to be paying is going to make a difference in the lives of people struggling with substance use disorder in Wisconsin. And that to me was the most important part of this. But another thing that we negotiated through this process was an extraordinarily broad document disclosure, really an unprecedented one. And it's going to include not only documents that were part of the discovery, but some documents that otherwise would be subject to attorney-client privilege. And what that's going to allow is for anybody who wants to dig into these documents to see what happened here and what unfolded. And it's going to allow people to help get a better understanding of what led to this epidemic so we can diagnose the causes of it and hopefully prevent some kind of future epidemic like this from happening.
You mentioned a lack of attorney fees being capped at this point. Do you have other regrets of the settlement that are not included that you wish were in there?
You know, this particular resolution, there will be, an allocation that divvies money up between the states and the local governments, and we'll set aside an amount for attorneys potentially. It's the state legislation that doesn't include the cap, but, the more resources that we can get for the state of Wisconsin to fight this epidemic, the better. And so our strategy has been to maximize the amount we can get. And so we're always pushing to get as many resources as we can. And I think we've gotten to the point here where we've maximized what we can get. We'd of course always love to get more, and we're going to keep fighting to get more resources from other companies that were engaged in unlawful practices that contributed to this epidemic. But that we got to the point where we think the bankruptcy is going to go forward either way, and that we've got to make sure we maximize those resources.
Looking at drug overdose deaths in Wisconsin, preliminary data from the CDC show that drug overdoses surged not only here in Wisconsin, but across the country. We had more than 1,500 people die. That's a 30% increase, nearly 30% increase year over year. What is your reaction to these overdose deaths?
Well, it's awful to see. The opioid epidemic has been devastating for families around not only the state, but around the country. And the overdose deaths are the most tragic aspect of that. This epidemic has also caused people to lose their jobs. It has imposed enormous strains on family, and this data is just another indication that we've got to do everything we can to fight this. It's also important to note that this is a sign of what's happened as a result of this pandemic. We have had significant social isolation, and there are a lot of consequences from that, and that we're going to be dealing with that fallout for years to come. And making sure that we invest in the kinds of programs that can address consequences of a pandemic, like mental health programs, substance use disorder programs, and other critical investments in our community. It's always important, but it's especially important in the wake of this pandemic.
We're talking with Attorney General Josh Call. What do you want to ask the AG about the opioid crisis? What about the open housing law litigation or the clergy sex abuse investigation? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more State Cap in a moment with Attorney General Josh Call here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing developments out of the State Justice Department. What questions do you have for Attorney General Josh Call about the state's investigation of abuse by Catholic priests and other faith leaders? What do you want to know about the status of this inquiry on the topic of housing? Are you concerned about discriminatory housing practices? Do you face eviction? 800-642-1234. Attorney General Josh Call stays with us for about 10 more minutes. Attorney General, before we move on, you mentioned communities must invest in programs now more than ever in the pandemic. With your agency in particular, aside from the lawsuits with drug makers, what are you doing to address the opioid crisis?
We have a sort of a three-phase approach that when it comes to fighting the epidemic. One is accountability, and that includes, as you mentioned, going after the big pharmaceutical companies, but it also includes the kind of long-term intensive investigations that go towards the large-scale drug traffickers, people who are transporting fentanyl or heroin or the other most dangerous drugs across state lines. And we've worked on a number of investigations into large-scale drug trafficking. Second is expanding access to treatment. We need to make sure that when people are struggling with substance use disorder, that they get the kind of treatment they need. The most recent state budget expands the TAD program, which provides treatment and diversion programs, by about $2.5 million. I would have liked to have seen greater investment in that program, but it continues to expand and move in the right direction. And then third, we need to keep working to prevent people from becoming addicted. And so we work to oversee the state's drug take-back program, which is consistently one of the top drug take-backs in the country that prevents drugs from being diverted. And we're continuously working to raise awareness about the dangers of opioid addiction to try to stop people from becoming addicted.
What about speeding up tests of opioids in the state crime lab?
I think that that's also an important part of working to resolve cases as quickly as possible. You know, a good example of that is that when somebody is arrested, it may be in their interest and in the public's interest to get them into a treatment program as quickly as possible. And when drugs can be tested more quickly, that allows that process to move forward. So we have continued to work to invest in our crime labs. The new budget doesn't include all of the investments we had requested in the crime labs. It doesn't include new toxicology positions, which we had hoped for, which would help with that process. But it does include funding for new instrumentation that will help us identify substances that can be toxic even at very, very low levels, including fentanyl, which is playing a significant role in this increase in overdose deaths.
Let's bring in Michelle in Middleton. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. Thanks for being on the program today, Attorney General. I have a question about educating youth and helping with programs for youth, not only in education on drugs and drug abuse, but also programs for young people with mental health. I feel like especially during the pandemic that people became ultra aware of the mental health problems in schools and with children today. And I think both of those things would be helpful to start younger.
Michelle, thank you. Attorney General.
Yeah, well, thank you, first of all, for that question, Michelle, and for the comment. I agree with you that we need to invest not only in funding for what we normally think of as education, things, the learning, reading and math, those things are vital, but it's also vital that we invest in social and emotional learning, as well as mental health programs, substance use disorder prevention, and those sorts of programs. Partly that's what that means is investing in things like counselors for schools, in mental health providers in our schools. At the Department of Justice, we have an Office of School Safety that helps with some of those efforts as well. We've created a tip line, which is known as the Speak Up, Speak Out program. And anybody who has information about school safety concerns can reach out to that tip line and get connected with services. And that includes people who are struggling with any sort of mental health issue, whether they themselves are looking for assistance or a student or a teacher or a parent knows somebody who is. So we encourage anybody who's looking for assistance in that respect to reach out.
Moving on to the clergy sex abuse investigation, last April you announced a statewide inquiry into sexual abuse by faith leaders, including the Catholic Church. And then we heard in June the Archdiocese of Milwaukee said it wouldn't cooperate and turn over documents. What is the status of your inquiry?
Well, that's right. We were disappointed that the Milwaukee Archdiocese chose not to take this opportunity to work collaboratively with us to get as much accountability and clarity on this issue as possible. But we are continuing to move forward with this review. A critical part of our review is to encourage people to report cases of clergy and faith leader abuse. And we announced recently that over 100 people have reported cases of abuse. So this is something that people are clearly using, and it's clearly needed. What we are providing is a trusted and safe place for survivors to report, and people can provide as much or as little information as they'd like. And when they reach out, they're connected with a trained victim services specialist. People can contact us either at supportsurvivors.widoj.gov or by calling 1-877-222-2620.
Are faith leaders cooperating in this investigation?
The response we've had so far has been uneven. We've reached out to dioceses and to religious orders in Wisconsin, and you know, some have provided more information than others. As you mentioned, the Milwaukee Archdiocese made clear publicly that they were not going to cooperate with a significant part of what we've requested, and unfortunately, a lot of other dioceses have followed suit. And it's part of the reason that these reports are so critical, because they are allowing us to get as full a picture as we can of what's happened with clergy and faith leader abuse in Wisconsin. The more cooperation we get, the more complete a picture we can get. But like I said, we're going to move forward with working to promote healing, with getting the measure of accountability that we can, and ultimately with trying to prevent future cases like this from happening again.
We're talking with Attorney General Josh Call. Let's go to Sharon from Lac des Flambeaux. Hi, Sharon.
Hello. Thank you very much. Great to hear you. Attorney General, I have a question about the recent permit that the DNR issued for the city of Waukesha to extract water out of Lake Michigan. My concerns are about, does this set a precedent for other communities that aren't really on the lake but nearby, and making sure that all of the state and federal Clean Water Act laws are in place for making sure the effluent that goes back into the lake is clean, is appropriate. And I can listen off the air.
Sharon, thanks. Attorney General.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Sharon. I can't speak to the details of that particular decision by the DNR. That one hasn't come to our office that I'm aware of. But what I can say is that when the DNR issues permits, there's a specific process that it needs to follow under state law. And it certainly needs to make sure that it's complying with applicable state and federal laws, including the Clean Water Act, in doing that. Our state Supreme Court recently issued a decision that relates to the not only the authority that the DNR has, but what it's required to do to keep our waters in public trust. And what the Supreme Court did was it upheld the principle that when issuing permits for high-capacity wells, the DNR needs to consider the impact on nearby waterways. And also when the DNR issues permits for CAFOs, for example, it has the authority to make sure that there's not going to be damage to nearby waterways. So that decision was a significant win. What that means for particular permitting decisions is going to vary by the case and by the circumstances, though.
Attorney General, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Josh Call is Attorney General of Wisconsin, and Call announced his candidacy for a second term earlier this month. The primary election is August 2022. Just ahead, the superintendents of three public school districts discuss their plans for the fall. What steps are you hoping schools prioritize? Join the conversation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.